Lauren O'Keefe's brother Dan was 24 when he walked out of their parents' home one winter's morning and disappeared. That was July 2011. Lauren and her parents thought it just wasn't like Dan to disappear like that. So Lauren quit her job and started an unrelenting search for Dan. Lauren has mounted a very smart public campaign to keep her brother's face in the public eye. It's called Dan Come Home. She's done interview after interview, walked mile upon mile, and probably worn out the internet, reaching out and sharing his photo and telling Dan's story. Lauren O'Keefe figures it's a numbers game, that one day the right person will see his face and match it with that quiet young man that they've seen around the place. Most of the time, Lauren and her family have been making things up as they go along. And on top of all this, Lauren's created an organisation that she wished had been around for her family when Dan went missing, a network for families of missing persons called MPAN, the Missing Persons Advocacy Network. Hi, Lauren.
Hello.
What was the shape of the O'Keefe family when you were growing up, and where do you fit in into the lineup of kids?
There are six of us, so mum and dad have four children. So there are three girls and then the baby boy, Dan. So Dan and I were the younger two, and then there were the two older sisters.
Families with four kids often pair off, don't they? They're like, there's
yes,
two against two.
Yeah, it was Dan and I versus the two older sisters, absolutely.
What sort of a kid was Dan?
Dan was, when he was younger, he was quite cheeky, you know, cheeky little boy. We fought like cat and dog. He drove me absolutely mad until about the age of about 11, I'd say, when we started to form quite a close friendship.
Given that he was the youngest one and the boy, was he dragged into girls' games all the time, like that?
I mean, I wasn't too big into the whole dolls and Barbie side of things. I was more trying to encourage him to play footy with me outside. But no, Dan was pretty grounded, and he, of course, being surrounded by women, was quite sensitive and very open with his feelings, and just a lovely, grew into an absolutely gorgeous young man.
Yeah, tell me about that young man he grew into.
He after school, he asked what I thought he should do in his gap year, and I suggested he go overseas and see the world and grow up a bit, and so he did just that, as I had done, and so he was able to travel by himself and came home just even more grounded, open-minded, just a really warm, caring, generous, beautiful human being. And throughout this whole time, he had maintained his passion in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is a martial art. So he came home at, I think, 22, 23 and started his own business. And just everyone always adored Dan. He's just a very warm kind of guy.
I've seen pictures of him, and he's really handsome.
He's gorgeous, isn't he?
Yeah, really handsome guy.
I know, but so modest. That's the thing. I was like, Dan, you could totally, like, when I was living in Japan through uni, I said, just come over here, be a model for like 6 months, make a ton of cash, and then retire. You could totally do that. And he's like, don't be silly, and he'd get all shy. And he was a very humble character. Even when he won the Pan Pacific Championships for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, when he was, I think, 20 or 21, he came home with a trophy, and we were all praising him, thinking, wow, this is amazing. And he was just, oh, don't be silly, and so shy and so modest always.
He had depression.
He did.
How serious was it? Was it the kind of run-of-the-mill late teens, early 20s depression, or was it more serious and requiring medication?
I think it progressed into that, and hindsight is something, isn't it? So when he was officially diagnosed at 24, it was bad by then. So he was encouraged to start taking medication. He was reluctant to do so because Dan is a very natural, pure kind of guy, would never even think of drinking or smoking a cigarette or taking drugs. And so,
oh, really? Didn't drink or smoke?
Gosh, no. Not at all. He was the picture of physical health. He treated his body like a temple, and so he was really against medication for his depression, but he had tried everything else at this point. And then it was a few weeks later that he went missing.
I have to ask this because it does have a bearing on what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Had he ever expressed suicidal thoughts to you or to anyone in his family or to his girlfriend?
In the 6 months before Dan went missing, when his depression was really bad, he came over to my apartment quite frequently, and would be just stuck in this very negative self-talk, and we'd go round and round, and I'd tell him, you know, he's going to get through it and we're all going to be here to support him. And there was one time I think he sort of very vaguely said, you know, I kind of wish I didn't have to be here, but I would never do that to you guys. And that was at a very low point. And then since that point, you know, he seemed to get better, and then...
Yeah, he found some spiritual sustenance through the Dalai Lama, actually. Tell me about that.
So Dan's girlfriend Susie and Dan would read The Art of Happiness together before they went to bed every night. And they found out that the Dalai Lama was actually coming to Melbourne in the June of 2011. And so Dan just had the most amazing time. I went over to their place for dinner, and I'd never seen him happier. And I thought, okay, he's getting better. It's actually working now, and he's going to get through this. That was mid-June.
What was going on in your life, Lauren, while all this was taking place?
Well, my partner and I had bought an apartment in Richmond in Melbourne, and I was working full-time in the city. Dan had become a pretty big part of my life. I mean, he was always a big part of my life. He was my brother. But at this point, the 6 months beforehand, he was calling me up to 10 times a day. You know, I'd have to leave work some days and just go and be there for him and hang out with him. And he was struggling, but we were getting through it.
How did Dan get on with your partner, Ruth, at the time?
They are extremely close. Ruth was like a sister to Dan. Dan would often call at all hours, like 3 a.m., but he'd call Ruth, and they would talk for hours on end while I kept sleeping. So they were extremely close.
Was that exhausting for you at some stage? Because it can be exhausting when a sibling that you love comes to you for
absolutely
in need all the time.
It can be, but I was very conscious of not making Dan feel as though he was a burden, because he would never be a burden, because I adore him. So I was saying what I thought was the right thing, and you know, that it's pretty draining 24/7 when there's no, well, seemingly there's no sort of outcome. He just would keep going on the same cycle of that negative self-talk. So it was pretty upsetting for me. But again, I tried to make sure he never felt like he was a burden on me.
What were the last occasions that you remember when you saw Dan?
When I saw Dan.
And you were with him.
Mm-hmm. It was Mum's birthday. And we had met up in the city for dinner with Mum and her best friend. And he didn't seem great that day. He did seem a bit down, which was, it's always upsetting, but especially after, you know, it was soon after the Dalai Lama thing when I really thought he was improving. So he seemed pretty down. I left about an hour before he did, and Mum had told me afterwards that he had pepped up and he was doing better, and so that was a bit of a relief. And that was the last time I saw him, which is unusual, because normally I would have seen him. I attended his classes. He had just opened an academy recently, so Ruth and I and Susie would go together to support him at his classes. I didn't see him. I had a really busy week, and Dan and I were training for Run Melbourne, which was coming up on the 17th of July.
This is a big like marathon event. It's tough,
yeah,
long,
so
we had distance running event.
Yeah, and we had, and we're not long distance runners by any means, but we had decided to raise money for Lifeline, because that was a service that Dan was very grateful for and wanted to thank them. And the last time I spoke with Dan, it would have been on the Thursday, the day before he went missing, and he said he was looking forward to running with me on Sunday.
What happened that morning he went missing?
So it was Friday morning. Dan was staying down at Mum and Dad's for, he'd been there for two or three nights. And
In Geelong.
So he was living with his girlfriend in Melbourne, but he was down in Geelong for a few nights and had forgotten to take his medication with him for those few nights. So I think without it, he really would have struggled to sleep, because his anxiety was just horrific. So he was undoubtedly sleep-deprived that morning when he was chatting with Dad at about 9 in the kitchen, but he seemed fine. You know, he had it together, and he and Dad were talking about that day. So Dan was going to head back up to the city to teach a class that night. And then 15 minutes later, after that conversation with Dad, where everything seemed normal, Mum came down from the other end of the house to say good morning to Dan, and he was gone. He hadn't taken anything with him, but of course, you know, he was 24, he had his own business, he lived up in Melbourne, they didn't panic. it wasn't until later on in the day when he still wasn't answering his phone that they thought this is quite unusual. And then it was that night when he didn't turn up to teach his class that we knew that something was wrong.
When did the police become involved?
That evening. So we had all called Dan's phone nonstop from mid-afternoon until about, I think his phone died about 9, and that's about the time that the police were notified. It's not a scenario that you ever think is going to happen. You know, you kind of go through life and you're aware of horrible things that happen every day. There are car accidents and people get cancer and people get divorced and all these bad things happen and you hear about them. But going missing was just not something that I had ever considered. I mean, why would I? It was something that happened in the movies. It doesn't happen in real life. Somehow, eventually fell asleep because I woke up the next morning at about 5, and then Ruth, Susie and myself went down to Geelong Police Station, and then that's when it all started sinking in.
So he left his home on foot because he left his car behind, but took his phone with him?
Dan's phone was in his pocket when he went missing.
What happened after you told the police?
Well, I wasn't there, but it was Mum and Dad at home who were dealing with the police. They said that they would come over and collect a photo, but that didn't happen. So Mum and Dad that night, I guess, were just besides themselves, waiting, hoping something was going to happen. And still, like, we thought Dan, being an adult male, could just have needed a breather and maybe he'd come back the next day, maybe he'd come back in the morning. So that was something that we were very conscious of as well.
Oh, you didn't want to overreact.
Of course. If he came back to this crazy, you know, mayhem where posters are everywhere and we've put it all over social media and all this stuff. So we were very wary of that in the first 3 days, which is why we kept it as quiet. It's bizarre. You know, we're putting up posters, but we were trying to deal with police and hospitals and crisis accommodation one-on-one so that it didn't become a public thing in case Dan's name was going to be forever tied to an online article that mentions the fact that he's struggling with depression.
And you wouldn't want to scare him off either, would you?
Of course
not. So if there's this big public campaign.
Absolutely.
Then that might actually hold him at bay.
Absolutely. So you're sort of torn between, okay, it's you're desperate to have help to find this person who you love. You don't want to scare them away.
And were you conscious of that during this process? That
yes.
You wanted to reach out and tell everyone to look for my brother.
Yes.
But didn't want to scare him off.
Absolutely. And so it's not a scenario that anyone is ever prepared for. You're not sleeping, you're not eating, you're not thinking clearly, and there was no direction. I asked the police that morning, after the 3 hours we spent with the police that morning, and I said at the end, okay, so what do I do now? What do I do? And they just said, well, just do whatever you feel like you need to do.
Police hate these cases, don't they? Because
they do.
They're open-ended.
Yep. There's no crime related to it. It's a non-suspicious case. He's an adult male. They have no resources for it. So who was supposed to help us? Who were we supposed to turn to? And there was no one.
Did you go looking?
Yeah.
Where did you look?
I looked. So Mum and Dad's house sort of backs onto a property. Like, there's a park and there are a few paddocks around. And, of course, you know, I was hopeful, but I was realistic. And I knew that Dan, having been suffering depression, could have had some sort of trigger and possibly committed suicide. And I know that when people commit suicide, generally they do it within a 4 kilometre radius of their home. And so I knew that given that area of where Mum and Dad live, I wanted to check the parks and I didn't want to, but I wanted to make sure that that wasn't the case. And so I searched. I mean, I'm not a professional, so I don't know what I'm doing. I wandered around, you know, terrified that I actually might find his body with my sister and also with Ruth and then with Susie again, until it got to a point where I think it was 2 months later I asked for the SES to do a search of that area just to make sure he definitely wasn't there. And the SES were keen, but they needed police approval, and because it was not a suspicious case and not a priority for Victoria Police, they weren't able to approve the search. And so
how about places like hospitals or,
oh, yeah,
or
we called,
hostels and
yeah,
the like?
So we called, in those first 48 hours, we called every hospital in Victoria, South Australia and New South Wales. We called crisis accommodation, homelessness services in those three states, because we were thinking if he's gone on foot, he may have hitched. He may have, you know, jumped on a train. We had PA systems like trucking companies, freight, putting the word out in case he'd, you know, been seen by anyone. We turned Mum and Dad's kitchen into a like a media hub. Like, we were dealing with journalists by that point, had seen the posters around Geelong that we'd been putting up. We'd been printing thousands of posters that made no sense. It was like pixelated photos of Dan. We forgot to put a phone number
on
it.
You put up a poster with a pixelated photo?
Of course, because we're like, okay, how do we get a high-res image? You're just frantic, you know. We're like, okay, well, his Facebook profile picture, that'll do, it's recent. So we just, you know, cropped it, and I don't think my laptop had Photoshop at the time, or something wasn't working, so we had to deal with like some super old school, like it could have even been Microsoft Paint, like it was so bad, but you're desperate. And so in hindsight, it's like, oh my gosh, we should have had this and we should have done that, and people aren't going to pay attention to a post that looks like that. So you're just not thinking clearly. My sister, Kate, the one just above me, she was actually overseas when Dan went missing. So that was another thing we had to consider. At what point should we notify her before she finds out on social media? We've got to make sure that Kate is aware, but we don't want to tell her and upset her in case he walks in tomorrow morning. So for those 3 days, we were, you know, thinking, what are we supposed to do? Who are we supposed to tell? And how are we supposed to reach out to certain members of the public, but then make sure that Dan's protected in case he does come home? And so it was very difficult.
How were your parents managing?
Yeah, that was... Mum was just paralysed, in shock, in bed. Oh, we were very lucky to have people bringing over lasagnas and sausage rolls, because that's the last thing that you want to do is cook, you know, and do the laundry. So yeah, the first few days were very, very tough. And Dad, I think, just tried to distract himself with work and gardening and some sort of normalcy, because he, you know, Dad doesn't know the first thing about a social media campaign. So, you know, that kind of had to be the kids. That was our role, was doing all of those things and ticking all of those boxes, whereas Mum and Dad, I guess, we were trying to help them as much as we could. So we wanted to assure them that things were happening. You know, they didn't need to do anything. We were taking control of the situation.
Are you angry with Dan?
Gosh, no. I could never be angry at Dan.
Not even after all this, if you thought he might have gone out into the world on his own and cut himself off?
No, not at all. Because that's... I don't think it's Dan. I know Dan. I've always known Dan. We've been very close. And it was not Dan that made that decision that morning to walk away. He has not done this to hurt anyone. Quite the contrary. I think he's done this thinking that it's the right thing to do for us. Because I worry that he felt that he was a burden, and that by removing himself from our family, our lives would be a bit easier. So I'm never, ever going to be angry at Dan.
Were you offered any help or guidance as a family?
I think Victoria Police, when they did come around to collect the photo on the second or third day, said that they would organise a counsellor for the family, which was not even really a priority for me. I just wanted to get things done. So the emotional support side of things was the last thing I had time for. But 3.5 years on, we're still kind of waiting for that that family counsellor. But we've individually, you know, sought our own treatments, and we've all taken very different approaches to this. But we've felt so supported from the very first day that we opened it up to the public when we started the Facebook page. And that's what's getting us through this.
So you decided after 5 days to make a public appeal.
That was just a blur, walking into that room and being that family on that stage with all the journalists. And I don't even think I spoke. I couldn't speak. I was a mess. So it was Susie, myself, and then Mum and Dad.
Because we've all seen those families on TV.
Yeah.
And then that thought occurred to you that now we're one of those families.
I can't believe we are one of these families. I can't believe that that's my brother's face that's going up on, you know, on screen. That was hard. It's that overwhelming hopelessness that you feel when it first happens, realizing that this is a huge country we live in, and there are lots of people, and there are lots of people that look like Dan, you know, brown hair, 6 foot, white guy.
Once the call was put out at that press conference, what kind of responses did you get?
We had a huge spike in Facebook likes. That first week, I think it was growing by hundreds a day, which at that point, because I had never seen a Facebook page, I was really reluctant to even start it because I thought, who on earth likes a page for a missing person? Like, it was, I'd never seen that before. It was such a bizarre kind of concept. And anyway, so to have hundreds of people joining the page, but not only that, then asking their Twitter followers to retweet the poster and just seeing it spread. I think we had like Hugh Jackman retweeted and Kim Kardashian retweeted. And in the first like fortnight, we had thousands of people talking about the fact that my brother was a missing person. With every new piece of information, the media seemed to really jump on it and go, oh, what's this about homelessness? You know, is this a possibility? And so then we were able to maintain that engagement with the public, and that has been invaluable.
You said he went with his phone. What would happen when you called his phone, Lauren?
Well, once we knew that he was missing, the battery had already been drained. So the police were then unable to triangulate his phone. So we have no idea what direction he even went in that day. I don't think he's intentionally taken his phone with him. I mean, Dan left without any other personal belongings. He left his wallet that had cash in it. He didn't take his passport, didn't take any identification. And he left in the type of clothing that Dan would never leave the house in. Dan was pretty presentable, and he kind of cared about what he looked like. I mean, it was morning, it was early, and so he was just bumming around the house in like old jeans and UGG boots and a hoodie, and that's what he left in, and that's very unlike Dan.
How did you get hold of his court records?
It became very apparent very early on that the police weren't really able to do as much as we expected that they were able to do, because in the movies, when you see when people go missing, they've got all this amazing technology and it's incredible what the police can do and how we can find people in this type of scenario. But we didn't have any of those resources. So,
like, and that an army was, of really good looking, well dressed CSI detectives
exactly,
didn't just parachute
like
into your house.
At all.
No, didn't happen. No.
Didn't happen. And so, we learned that very early on. And so we sort of had to go about things a bit sneakily, I guess. And we had a contact who worked for the telco that Dan was with at the time. And so one of us was able to sneakily retrieve Dan's phone records. I think it was about a month or so after he'd gone missing.
And what did the call record show?
It showed that Dan was in a bad way that morning, and that although he seemed okay when he was speaking with Dad at 9 o'clock, a couple of hours prior he was dialing some pretty strange numbers.
What do you mean?
Oh, just it was a succession of, you know, 04 000 000 04 111 111 111 04 22 22 22.
Not real phone numbers.
Not real phone numbers. Just a pattern.
Just numbers.
Yeah, I know that that's completely out of character for Dan to do something like that, but I don't know what was going on in his mind.
What led your dad to suggest that Dan might have become homeless by choice?
I think we were just, like I said, we had considered the possibility that Dan had committed suicide. So we'd also considered the possibility that he had either chosen or just found himself living on the streets. We had also considered that he'd gone to live on some sort of alternative type of commune, or that he'd pursued a lifestyle aligned with Buddhist ideals. So many things we've considered. But in the early stages, I think the homelessness one was sort of focused on, because Dan, in a very endearing way, would often approach people on the streets, homeless people on the streets, and just start a conversation and ask about how they ended up like this in a really non-threatening. Dan is such a naturally charming guy, so they would open up and tell him stories, and he was curious. Dan, that's just the kind of guy that he is. He's really curious and open-minded, and he's a great conversationalist, and so we thought maybe, you know, having done that and asked those questions, it could have been something that he was wanting to pursue, possibly. I mean, nothing made sense, so we thought maybe this is something.
Drawing a long bow here, but, you know, he'd taken interest in Buddhism, which talks about learning how to practice detachment from worldly things. Is it possible he might be trying to live a life like, I don't know, Christopher McCandless, the guy, the book that Into the Wild was about, mm-hmm. who disappeared into the Alaskan wilderness to see if he could live on his own in the wilderness?
It is absolutely possible, and we have had countless people come to us and suggest just that. Dan is a very resourceful young man. Like I said, he's travelled the world by himself. He's always been fearless. So that too is a possibility.
And those conversations with homeless men,
yeah.
Do you think that came out of a sense of compassion or envy?
I think more compassion. I don't feel that in the moments where Dan had sort of very vaguely touched on the possibility of going away, and, you know, that could be taken as suicide or it could be taken as just having a break, he would say, but I wouldn't want to hurt you guys. I would never do that to you because I'd really miss you. And so I don't think that it was something he was realistically considering. So I think more so that it would have been coming from a place of compassion and just genuine curiosity.
Your mum made a really lovely public appeal. Here's what she said.
Well, if there's by any rare chance that Dan is watching this, Dan, you know we love you more than all the world. You've always known that. We love you so much, mate. We miss you. Please come home. Or please let us know where you are. We'll come to you. Give us a call. We'll help you in whatever way we can. We just love you, darling.
It's weird listening to... feels like a lifetime ago.
It sort of brings to mind that famous John Donne poem, you know, no man is an island. So maybe if he has chosen to disappear and be alone, he's chosen to live like that island, but it just seems interesting that his disappearance has brought a whole lot of other people together and bound them even tighter. It's strange, isn't it?
I think it's beautiful. Yeah, it is. It is strange. We could never have imagined the response that we've had to this search. The compassion of strangers. People will write to me and say, because of Dan's story, I myself have sought treatment for my own mental illness because I had considered going missing and walking away from my family, but I know what it's going to do to my family because I've seen it happen to yours and I recognise that I need help. And so they're the kinds of stories that mean that no matter what happens with Dan, none of this has been in vain. He has helped so many people, and we'll never know how many.
Well, he hasn't done that. You've done that, Lauren.
No, I'm just... No, this has come about because Dan, people, they see Dan and they think that could easily be my brother or my best friend or my son. And it's, you know, he's the guy next door. And so we've just been very fortunate for people to be able to see that in him.
Your grandmother is past her 100th year on
time. Oh, yeah. She's turning 102 in a couple of weeks, less than, 10 days.
Does she have a view on this?
Dan had gone up to visit Nana, I think, the day before he went missing. And so they were having a cup of tea and chatting. And Nana thinks that maybe he's just gone away to explore, find himself, and he'll come back home when he's ready. I mean, she's almost 102. It's, you know, she's gone through all the world wars. She's seen a lot of bad things happen, and I'm really sad that she's had to see this happen as well, but I'm glad that her take on it is positive, and I always try and make her aware of, you know, she doesn't know what Facebook is, but I show her the page and I read her some of the comments and emails, and she just thinks it's wonderful.
Psychics. Were you contacted by psychics?
Oh, yeah. Boy, were we. We still are. Yeah, we were very early on psychics and PIs that were offering their services pro bono, private investigators. And I think a lot of people like that wanted in and wanted to express their opinions based on their gifts or their skills. There was one renowned psychic that Mum went up to visit, and she had told Mum a story about what had happened, and it was that Dan had been walking along a highway in the middle of the night, pitch black, and someone had accidentally hit Dan and killed him, and decided to, you know, take his body and bury it in a shallow grave, and it wasn't too far from where Mum and Dad's house is, so they went out there and had a little bit of a look around. But and just, you know, the fact that they were doing that really breaks my heart. And then it turned out that there was a very similar story that had happened, I think, a month or so later. That event did occur, it just wasn't our Dan. that it had happened to. It was a very similar set of circumstances. So it was a bit of a relief, I think, for Mum to go, okay, well, you know, that happened. It wasn't our Dan. But to still be back at square one and going through that vulnerability every day and having strangers tell us these stories, you know, these psychics put forth these horrible graphic images that a parent or a loved one should never have to visualize.
You said you had an initial search of the paddocks around your parents' house.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get the SES or the police to be engaged in the largest search.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had another go using social media to do it. Tell me about that.
After we had initially appealed to Victoria Police and been denied, and then I had subsequently sent a letter to the Minister for Police, which they hated because I think that drew more media attention, and they still denied it, I then turned to social media because we did have that huge audience. And I, you know, I've never conducted a ground search before. I have no idea what I'm doing. Every element of this is brand new for me. So I didn't want to promote it too heavily in case we had lots of people come along. So I just made a very quiet event, and there were about 100 people from all over the state that came down. It was for a Saturday morning. We were going to start out at 9 a.m. and go all day.
100 people showed up?
100 people, most of whom we didn't know.
And did you even have any idea of how to go about this?
Not really. I'd stayed up. It would have been, so the Friday night before the Saturday morning search, I was in the kitchen, you know, I had all these maps printed out. And then my sister said, oh, we should have organised a metal detector because Dan, you know, he left with his phone in his pocket. And I was like, Kate, it's a bit late, you know, it's about midnight on a Friday. How on earth? And who even still owns a metal detector? I mean, it's so 90s.
You'd be surprised.
Well, I was because I did a post. I was like, okay, it's worth a shot. So I did a post on the Facebook page after midnight on a Friday. And what do you know, at 9 a.m., this man rocks up in his late 50s wearing a cap with a metal detector and says, I don't know why I'm here, but my wife told me to be here. That is fantastic. And he spent the whole day in the paddocks with his metal detector, you know, searching for what could have been Dan.
So nothing was found. In the end, though, I suppose that's the... Is that the best outcome you could have hoped for on that day, was that nothing would be found?
Absolutely. And just the whole event in itself was the first time I knew that we didn't need police. We had people power. And that is invaluable in the context of a non-suspicious missing persons case for an adult male. That was the real turning point. That's when I knew we really had something. And this is 2 months after he went missing.
When all this happened, you'd had a job. Was that the last you ever saw of that job after Dan walked out the door?
So I was an online communications advisor for the Department of Education. So my boss, though, was aware of what was going on. And then, of course, through the traditional media, a few days later, everyone was aware of what was going on. So I'd go into the office and it was just awkward, because everyone knew what was going on. No one knew what to say. What do you say to someone? I mean, it's hard enough when people pass away. What do you say to someone who's just lost their family member?
I don't know. What do you say? What can people say that's helpful under those circumstances?
Well, for me, I think I needed some positivity. So if they had have said, like, okay, I have just retweeted the poster for Dan all across and I'm doing this for you and I wanted things to be done. So I was not ready to have pity. I was not ready for any kind of sympathy or empathy because I knew that no one knew what I was going through. So I didn't even want an attempt. I wanted people to help me. But instead, it was just silence because it's uncomfortable because no one knows what to say.
How were you sleeping?
I wasn't. I don't think I slept really for a couple of months. First 4 months, I was just a maniac. Every waking moment was writing an email, making a call. I was constantly surrounded by at least 3 screens. I had all of my fingers on all of the pulses. I could not miss a beat. So I was way too highly strung to even consider sleep.
What's it like to walk around the street when someone like Dan is missing? Do you ever notice how hard you're looking at people in the street?
I honestly... I think in the early days, I think other members of the family found that really difficult because they would be distracted. They'd be, you know, driving down the street in Geelong or somewhere in Melbourne and turn back and think, oh, was that Dan? But I felt immediately that if Dan was alive, he wasn't in Victoria. I knew that he wasn't in Victoria. We had completely doused the traditional media in Victoria in those first few weeks. So I knew I wasn't just going to walk down the street and pass Dan. So I wasn't sort of, I didn't have that alert system. I was really mostly in my dressing gown in the kitchen running the whole media hub. You know, I wasn't out there actively searching because I knew he wasn't going to be just walking down, you know, Collins Street.
Someone tried to scam the family. It was a hoax.
Yeah. So unfortunately, with things like this, you see the best in people, but you can also see the worst. And so we did have a hoax email sent.
What was the message?
It was a group. I think they were based in Uganda, even, that had Dan, and they were drugging him and torturing him. And that unless we paid them a sum of $100,000, they were going to kill him.
Oh, ridiculous.
Ridiculous. And, of course, that is ridiculous. I would not have for a second believed that, but it went through to, you know, mum and dad see this email. They are vulnerable parents. They are desperate. They're not, you know, they're from a different generation. So they don't get the whole Nigerian scam thing you get. So they maybe for a second could have thought there's something to this until I communicated to them that it was absolutely ridiculous. And they didn't have Dan. They don't even know where Dan is. That was difficult. But we've had lots of, you know, weirdos use Dan's image for online dating profiles. We've had, you know, we've come across some really sick things, and I'm not immune to it. It still really hurts, but it's been 3.5 years and I'm kind of a bit hardened to it now.
So your family, after 5 months, offered a reward of $50,000.
Yes.
For information. What happened after you announced that?
That was possibly the best thing that we did because it led to a significant amount of traditional media attention. And this is 5 months on, as you said, and we were really, really keen to get the story outside of Victoria because, like I said, I was sure that if Dan was alive, he was not in Victoria, so we needed to get the story out there. And so we announced the reward and did multiple interviews that day. And then at the end of the day, I went into a Network 10 studio and did a piece for the project. And we were talking about the reward, of course, but then as we're talking about Dan, all of the images of Dan are popping up on screen.
Who saw that?
There was a woman who works at a medical clinic in southeast Queensland who had thankfully asked her husband to record that night's episode of the project on Channel 10 because there was a segment about sustainability that she really wanted to watch. So the husband recorded that program, and the following day she sat down and watched the whole episode and saw our interview about Dan and all the images of Dan popping up on the screen. And she realized that that was the man that had walked into her medical clinic 2 weeks prior to ask for a glass of water. He wasn't seeking medical treatment. He had asked her if it was okay if he could just get a glass of water. And so it was herself and the cleaner had spoken with this man face to face for 10 minutes. And as soon as she realized that the man that she'd spoken to was a missing person from Victoria, she called her colleague. They went onto our website, dancomehome.com. They looked at the photo gallery, both of them, 100% convinced it was him. So they then went to their medical board to make sure that they weren't breaching privacy, because the Privacy Act is a big deal, and I get that. The board said no, because he wasn't seeking treatment. He's a member of the public. He was just having a glass of water, so that's fine. So then with that, they did what they thought was the right thing to do, which is what the public is encouraged to do in this situation, and they called Crime Stoppers, even though going missing is not a crime. And Dan is not a criminal, and this is a non-suspicious case, as deemed by Victoria Police. So this report was taken in Queensland. It was the 22nd of December 2011. 2 or 3 weeks later, it was the 4th of January, that the receptionist from this medical clinic had called Crime Stoppers back, quoted her reference number and said, look, I just really want to make sure that this guy has been found, that he's okay. And the volunteer from Crime Stoppers told her it was, you know, it was not any of her business. And so she persisted, went to our website again and called our hotline phone. So she told my sister everything that had happened that night. This man, who we've since realised was Dan, had walked into a medical clinic in southeast Queensland, spoken with these two women, said his name was James, said he was from Melbourne.
Why was James significant?
Because James is Dan's middle name. And this guy was a physical match to Dan. He was 6 foot, brown hair, white guy from Melbourne. This guy walks in with two bags, you know, those reusable shopping bags. And these two women realise that he is sleeping rough. He says that he's been sleeping in the parks around Brisbane. They then offered him money to help him to get back to Brisbane. And he politely declined. He was very polite. He was very well-spoken. And he was carrying all of his worldly possessions in two reusable shopping bags.
They could tell you all this, but there are a lot of guys in their 20s who are 6 foot tall with brown hair mm-hmm. who are sleeping rough
yep.
in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
How could you be assured?
So I immediately, that day on the 4th of January, when I got that call from Mum said, how soon can you be in Brisbane? And I said, why? And so she sent the report through, and I got goosebumps, and I knew Dan was alive. Just everything that this woman had made note of just was Dan to a T, and the fact that it had happened at a clinic in Ipswich, not just any clinic, a clinic that he had been to with his ex-girlfriend, well, his girlfriend at the time, Susie. She's from there. Her grandparents live around the corner. I knew it was Dan.
Was there any way, any camera images of him that you could actually witness and see for yourself?
I was aware from the initial report that there was a security camera in the clinic, and I was desperate to see that footage. So I jumped on a plane. I didn't tell anyone what I was doing in case the police became aware and then prevented me from accessing the CCTV because of the Privacy Act, which makes no sense in this context. But anyway, so I was hoping that I could charm, and as ridiculous as that sounds, to have to charm the manager of this clinic into letting me see the footage. So I rocked up that day. I had all of my photos. I interviewed each woman one-on-one for about an hour, and then at the end, the manager said, look, I probably shouldn't do this, but I'm going to let you look at the CCTV. So then, sitting in this office, gosh, it's so, so bizarre, but I was sitting in this office with Katie and these two women, and on this screen walks a very frail version of my brother. He'd lost like 30 kilos.
Could you see his face? Most CCTV footage is shot from above, hair and hats or whatever get in the way of the face. Could you actually see the
Thank
face?
Thank God,
though?
Yes. It was perfectly positioned. So when he walks into frame, you get to see his face front on. And then he turns around and he's speaking with women. Then he sits down. And it's funny how when you're close to someone, you notice small things. So like when he sits down and he's drinking a glass of water, we can see, like, we're like, oh, that's how Dan. And I'm not crazy. I'm not just wanting it to be Dan. Like the police have said, maybe you just want it to be Dan. Of course, any family in this situation is going to want to, but I think I have my wits about me. And we've had plenty of reported sightings of Dan, but this is Dan. And I was confident of that before I even saw the footage because of the location, the fact that his name is James, which is Dan's middle name, the fact that he's polite and well-spoken and friendly and charming and non-threatening and all of these things.
So you saw that face and you thought, there's no doubt in my mind that that's him?
Absolutely not. I called Mum and Dad straight away and I said, it's him. They flew up and we were all in the office together watching that footage again. And Mum and Dad, upon seeing it, thought that he has walked from Geelong to Ipswich in those 4.5 months. Possibly hitched a ride, you know, some of the way. But Dan used to go for long walks to clear his mind, and I wouldn't put it past him. He is an absolute ninja.
So, Lauren, you then, I suppose, searched all over southeast Queensland, Brisbane and southeast Queensland to see, did you find any evidence of his existence, any sign of him, any other reports of him in southeast Queensland?
There's a pretty significant homeless population in Queensland, so I spoke one-on-one with over 1,000 people for those 6 to 8 weeks. And it was draining. I was giving these business cards out to volunteers from various homelessness services. I was going to church groups that host free dinners and things like that. I was trying to live that kind of, I was waking up 5 a.m. to go to the first round of soup kitchens or food vans for breakfast, and then there was lunch, and then there was dinner, and then there was supper. And this is all around Brisbane and Greater Brisbane. And it was exhausting going into these men's shelters where, because of the Privacy Act, I could ask, have you seen my brother? They can't say yes or no. So they would say, but, you can leave a note here, and if, maybe if we see him, we can give him the note. So I'd be going around to these shelters and writing letters to Dan just to let me know if he was okay. That was really tough.
Could Dan fail in any way to be aware of this massive national search you've put out for him?
As surprising as it may sound, yes, he could fail to be aware, because Dan was never interested in social media, never really interested in news so much. He kind of just floated around, he'd speak to people one-on-one, and that was more enriching for him. He lived that kind of lifestyle.
Is it possible he spotted you at a distance, walking into a homeless shelter, stepped into the shadows and watched you ask for him?
I mean, anything is possible. I think that that's highly unlikely. In the hundreds of people that I spoke with one-on-one, I think it would have... There were two that I believe did possibly actually see Dan in that period. It was late December, and there was some sort of pre-Christmas dinner, and these two men saw a guy that didn't look like a typical homeless person. He was this young, handsome guy that kept to himself and was sort of sitting away from everything. I believe that maybe, it could have been him, maybe it was, but regardless, I think that Dan, given that he's gone from Geelong to Ipswich in 4.5 months, he's not hanging around, he's on the move. He could be anywhere by now, and it's a really big country.
So now you've shifted your focus now to creating this network to help other people in the similar situation as you.
It got to a point where there were lots of other families contacting me, calling me and emailing me and saying, Lauren, my brother is missing, or my friend is missing, my daughter is missing, can you please help me? What do I do? Because, probably they were asking the police and they were getting the same response we did. And so at this point, I think I'd already composed a very rough draft of this idea that I had for a website to guide people through what to do. Because I just thought, in this day and age, when there is a YouTube tutorial on how to like boil an egg or how to tie a shoelace, how is it that there's no direction for what to do when someone disappears? And so it got to a point where I thought, this is so much bigger than Dan. I need to step away from the Dan Come Home campaign so that these people actually have adequate support. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to start a charity. Because there is no charity in Australia that gives families of missing persons practical support. And that was the start of all of this now, MPAN, it's going great.
I'm really conscious of how much psychic torture there is in these things. And I can't help but wonder too, and I'm sure the thoughts occur to you, that maybe your brother is aware of this gigantic public campaign. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's waiting for the fuss to die down before he feels and to get quiet before he can quietly creep back into your lives. Has that thought occurred to you?
Of course. But we as a family had to decide that that's a risk that we decided to take. And it's, we revisit that possibility often and we think, okay, maybe in a couple of months we'll tone it all down for a while and give him an opportunity. If that's in fact what is happening, let's, make that a possibility for him. But we don't know, and it's the not knowing, and it's the waiting, and it's the worrying, and the fact is that Dan, this is so unlike him. Something has happened that morning that makes us have a very real and warranted concern for his welfare, so we can't take that risk. We need people to help us. We just need to know that he's okay, so we don't need to physically locate him if that's the case and he doesn't want to be found. We need to be aware that that was the decision that he made, but until we know that for sure, we need to know that he's all right, that he's alive.
Are you surprised by yourself in this campaign? I'm struck by how relentless you have been with this, and how your ability to make something out of nothing without knowing anything beforehand. I mean, if Dan hadn't disappeared, do you think you might have decided one day, it's ridiculous we haven't had manned space flight to Mars? You know, and you could be on the launch pad now or something. I mean, are you surprised? Seriously, are you surprised by how much energy and determination you've been able to make this thing?
This is my baby brother. I don't think I could have found this amount of passion and determination for something else. It's deeply personal, and I never imagined that I would be able to find a career that I felt this passionate about. So I really see it now that it is a career, that it's a gift from Dan, that I'm able to love what I do and to hopefully help people, you know, to alleviate some of that stress that they're going through, especially in those first 72 hours of learning that a loved one's disappeared. There is somewhere to turn now, and that's all thanks to Dan.
I hope he does come home.
Oh, me too.
You could put all this energy into, I don't know, curing Ebola or something like that.
maybe. We'll see.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
Thanks, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.